Russian soldiers are on rotation, about to head to the front to replace their comrades. On the way, it's tense. Russian forces are making a major attempt to overrun Ukrainian positions that have been largely static for 8 years. The soldier thinks he hears a drone. Both sides are dropping grenades on each other.
I was at this position about a month ago. It was reasonably quiet. Now it's a different story. Incoming artillery, small arms fire. The outskirts of Donetsk has now become one of the places of most fierce fighting in this war.
We run across open ground. The Ukrainian lines are only 100 meters away. Our position is hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and we are hurried underground. Europeans are once again slaughtering each other in brutal trench warfare. As tension grows between the Western and Eastern worlds, these soldiers aren't the only ones concerned that the next world war may well be already underway in this wintry grey zone wasteland in Donbass. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Hamas's Council on International Relations has held an international conference on the impact of the Israeli blockade. The event aims to shed light on the crippling Israeli blockade on more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. The event was attended by figures representing the Gaza Government Committee and civil society organizations. They discussed ways to tackle the repercussions of the blockade. Living conditions and the standard of living in the Gaza Strip have been rapidly deteriorating under the Israeli blockade. The Hamas movement says Western countries, mainly the United States, are supporting the Israeli blockade.
The Israeli siege, unfortunately supported by the international community, mainly the Americans, have converted Gaza into the biggest open-air prison on earth. We can see the catastrophic impacts of this siege in every corner here in the Gaza Strip, which can develop up to a crime against humanity or an ethnic cleansing.
Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade.
More than 2 million Palestinians, most of them children, women, elders, and patients, are suffering from this catastrophic condition due to the continuous blockade for more than 15 years. The international community silence leads to continue such offensive on Palestinians.
Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the war to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Back on November 28, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left 5 people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, 3 of her relatives and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, 3 women, a boy called Nora John, and the driver Mohammed Nabi were martyred.
The U.S. crimes in Afghanistan are unforgivable. In fact, the U.S. government supported and empowered terrorists on our land and hurt civilians and innocent people. Now, as facts are surfacing, we understand that the U.S. war on terror was a game and a pretext to justify America's presence in the region.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes.
We have proof that the U.S. and its allies committed war crimes in Afghanistan. During their night raids, mass bombardments, and land missions, many innocent people were killed and their properties were damaged. The 2019 U.S. drone attack in Khost is one of many instances. Today, the families of victims are calling for investigations into such unlawful killings and compensation for their losses.
According to verified reports, throughout the two-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bakeries from around Italy have warned the government that their activities are at risk of shutting down if they won't receive financial help as soon as possible. Trade associations and representatives of the bakery industry met the Business and Made in Italy Minister Adolfo Urso on Friday to demand subsidies and safeguard measures to tackle the dramatic rise in the cost of raw materials, such as flour, diesel oil, packaging and equipment.
Flour has gone up from around 4.5 euros per kilo to around 8 euros. The cost of mozzarella has gone up by 30%, that of tomatoes has doubled, and the same goes with cost of equipment. The government must do something to save bakeries, as we are disappearing. The quality and freshness of products from small specialized stores like ours is hard to beat.
Smaller family-owned bakery shops in Italy are slowly disappearing, giving place to large supermarkets. A cost-of-living crisis, rising inflation and energy prices have badly affected many of the around 26,000 bakeries, which employ about 100,000 workers across the country. Power bills have doubled in Italy over the past months amid the energy crisis sparked by the Ukraine war. This is while the country's annual inflation rate was almost 12% in October, the highest level since March 1984.
All prices have increased a lot. The cost of energy, raw materials, everything has gone up by at least 40%.
Prices have gone up also in supermarkets where there is no more food in offer. But where prices have gone insane is at work. I am employed by a communication agency and the quotations we receive have doubled.
Earlier this week, the Giorgia Meloni government announced its draft 2023 budget bill, which includes measures aimed at channeling 35 billion euros towards families and businesses in order to ease the burden of high inflation and power bills. Many fear these measures will do little to shield the Italians. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea's President Kim Jong-un has said that building the nuclear force is the most important cause, adding that the new ICBM clearly proved to the world that North Korea is a full-fledged nuclear power and can stand against the supremacy of the U.S. What are the reasons for his announcements, and how will the U.S. react hearing that, especially since Kim Jong-un has said that North Korean scientists have made a wonderful leap forward in technology for mounting nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles? Just a few of the topics and issues we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, joins us from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, also joins us from Bristol.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, first to you. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, saying that his country aims to have the world's most powerful nuclear force. He said that while celebrating the launch of this new intercontinental ballistic missile at a ceremony which some were surprised to see his daughter. Not that it wasn't known how important nuclear weapons are to North Korea. Why do you think this is coming at this time and it being displayed in the way that it is?
Well, let's cast our minds back 4 years or so to the Donald Trump era, where actually Kim Jong-un and Trump were embracing each other, and actually there was a rapprochement going on. Trump had basically cut through all of the diplomatic nonsense that the State Department, it's almost like a firewall, really, with these bureaucrats at the deep state set up, and Trump had managed to cut through that. In order to literally sit down with Kim Jong-un in North Korea and say, look, listen, you know, we can get along, we can start to trust each other from the presidential level down, you know, and that has all, it seems, been falling apart. But in the backdrop to all of this, and I think we've got to just look at the nuclear weapons era after the Second World War, as the United States became initially the sole controller of nuclear weapons, and other countries then got on the nuclear bandwagon. Well, of course, it wasn't a bandwagon because they realized that this was the weapon of the future, and anybody who had this weapon would be able to intimidate, you know, not only other countries, but their own population into going along with various plans to do with possible wars. If you go back to 1956, where the British were attacked in Egypt and the Americans refused to help us, I think that was the right thing to do, actually, because it was the end of the colonial era. But the Americans at that point really started to, on a plan for what was an attempt at world domination. And I think that we have to just be realistic about this. The Americans don't say this. They never say this in any official capacity.
Right.
But anyone that pays attention to world affairs knows that that's what the United States wants. And there's only one thing which will stop you being dominated by the United States, it seems. And other countries like Libya, etc., Iraq, etc., have realized this, and that is nuclear weapons are the only things the Americans understand. If you've got nuclear weapons, they won't attack you. But if you haven't, they may do, and at some point they probably will do. And so I think the Americans have actually made this situation for themselves by the combination of being the first major nuclear power, with Henry Kissinger putting the strategy forward to all this, and then also by having the unified command structure around the world where the US military attempts to dominate every inch of the planet. This is, I think, what's created the reaction from Kim Jong-un and nothing else.
Well, taking a look at what our guest Tony Gosling said, Richard Becker, first of all, let's take a look at what this intercontinental ballistic missile is that Kim Jong-un is so raving about. It's called the Hwasong-17, dubbed the monster missile, believed to be capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Now, given the fact that they are now in possession of this, what do you think the U.S. is actually thinking, or how should it react? Or at this point, is the fact that North Korea is capable of having and making this type of intercontinental ballistic missile mean that it's not even interested in any negotiations on its missile capabilities?
Yes. So I do think that they are interested, very interested in negotiations, but there have to be real negotiations. In 2018, there was the meeting in Singapore, which your other guest referenced, which looked like it could move toward, the situation could move toward a breakthrough. But in Hanoi in 2019, that collapsed. The negotiations collapsed suddenly. And according to CNBC, the network here, it collapsed because Trump came into that meeting with a piece of paper and written in English and Korean and saying that North Korea should turn over its weapons and its weapons-grade fuel, to the United States. And that was it. That was the end of the agreement. Now, that was really, we believe, Bolton and Pompeo. Bolton's been a longtime advocate of exterminating North Korea altogether. He was asked once what his policy was in regard to North Korea, and he said no North Korea. So you had those elements take over. And whereas in 2018, there was an agreement to limit or halt testing on the part of North Korea if there was also an end to the so-called war games, which aren't really war games at all, by the U.S. and South Korea simulating invasions of North Korea. And this year, they were back at a very high level. That was in August. And they openly stated, the U.S. commanders openly stated that part of those military maneuvers, those war games, and you never know if they're games until they're over, but part of them was the assassination of Kim Jong-un, the leader of the country. The New York Times said he might have taken it personally. Well, no kidding. if the most powerful military in the world said, we're rehearsing to kill you or to assassinate you and to destroy your government, well, of course you have to understand what that really means. So that's the reality of the situation, is that what was at one time appeared to be a promising steps toward normalization of relations, an end to the war. There has never been an end to the Korean War, the U.S.-Korea War. It's an armistice agreement, and the North Koreans very much want an end to this status of war. They want a peace agreement with the United States, and they want a lifting of the economic sanctions, which have done so much damage to North Korea and the people of North Korea, as they have to so many other countries in the world.
I'm going to ask you the same question, Tony Gosling. I mean, we could take a look at the previous attempts that were made by the U.S. And North Korea in terms of trying to reach some kind of a deal. But aren't we looking at a new landscape now? I mean, we're looking at a landscape where in Russia is somewhat disconnected from the West, in a matter of speaking. They're not really interested in the West, and they're shifted, really aligning themselves with China. Do you think North Korea is still very much interested in wanting some kind of a deal with the U.S. in particular for sanctions to be lifted, given the fact that, I'm guessing that China is one way or another backing North Korea?
Well, it's a very important point, yes. I mean, in a way, North Korea is just a kind of policy maneuver of China that it can do at arm's length. So it can, what they're doing through, I think, in North Korea is much of the things that the Chinese would like to say and like to do, but the Chinese are far, far more sensible, and they're trying to keep a good diplomatic relationship with the United States. But the U.S. has caused so much trouble for itself by throwing its weight around and trying to, well, I mean, what they've done is they've used this economic warfare for the last 20 years to bully and badger various countries around the world. And what's been the result? Well, it's meant that the U.S. is not trading with so many countries now that actually the U.S. economy itself is collapsing. And the Chinese are doing very well out of this. I mean, they've got a very well-oiled, and they've got actually quite a well-organized state in China, whereas the state in the U.S. and much of Western Europe is starting to collapse. The big corporations taking over, the government, basically finding it almost impossible to get in tax revenue because it's so weak. And so I think it's quite clear that, yes, the North Koreans do want to negotiate with the United States. But the thing is, as Vladimir Putin said, I think it was about 8 months, maybe a little bit longer ago now, the beginning of 2022, I heard him say something in one of his speeches along the lines of, well, the United States is not deal ready. This is a great expression because he's saying we can sit at the table with them all day, but we cannot actually get them to make a deal that they'll stick to. And they might even say something, but then they'll go away and they'll say, oh, we're very sorry, but our diplomats back in Washington have told us that we can't do this. So he's saying that to a certain extent, although they're always willing to sit down and talk to the United States, they're finding that they're basically banging their heads against a brick wall. And that is because the deep state in the U.S. is in in free fall, rather like the last days of Rome, when the Roman Empire was so corrupt on the inside that the various machines of diplomacy stopped working for the Romans. And, of course, their empire then stopped working. And I think we're seeing a similar sort of collapse with the US now. Many people would love to do deals with the United States, sensible, mature, adult deals, which would see all their people's successful growth of trade in the future, trusting relationships. Mm-hmm. But we've got a deep state in the US that doesn't want that to happen because it's afraid of its own position. What we've seen is that, you know, there's various problems at the center of the US, not least of which has been revealed by the Epstein scandal. And these people are worried that if law and order breaks out in the international community, that the United States, the leaders of the deep state in the United States, the organized criminals, basically, may be just going to jail or worse, maybe being executed. So they're fighting a rear guard action, which is affecting their relationship with the entire world.
This is a very curious situation, Richard Becker, when you take a look at the landscape in that part of the world in terms of the what the U.S. is doing. And my question to you is whether the U.S. does not want tensions to decrease. Now, when I say that, I mean the U.S. is busy trying to militarize. I shouldn't say trying to militarize the region. It's selling arms to the countries in that region, especially to the ones that are allied to it. Now, one of the main reasons it's doing that is, aside from North Korea, is the ultimate goal of China, because we know, obviously, the U.S. has a focus on China. And it does not want tensions then to be reduced because it could continue with these arms sales like it did with Japan. Japan said that I'm going to quadruple my defense spending. I'm going to buy all these missiles, especially howitzers, I think, which reach deep inside mainland China. It wants to keep that at that level because it's going to somewhat be preparing not only itself but its allies in the region to confront China ultimately. Do you think that that's the correct way of looking at it?
Well, I think that there's no question that the pivot to Asia, as it was called, is aimed first and foremost at China. But North Korea also has an important role now, and the relations between them are strong, it appears, as they are between North Korea and Russia. And Russia and China, but particularly China, is the main target of the pivot to Asia and this huge buildup, which has seen vast deployment of U.S. military forces, increased military forces. There were already vast forces there in the Indo-Pac Command, as they call it, the Pacific Command. And this is an important factor in this. And the military buildup in Japan is also, it's also worth noting, Korea used to be, was for decades, a colony of Japan. And now the right wing and the militarists in Japan, they find it intolerable that they don't have nuclear weapons when their former colony does, North Korea being half of what their former colony was. And that's a big issue in Japan among the right wing. And if the this process continues, the military buildup on the part of and nuclear buildup on the part of Korea, the pressures inside Japan grow for Japan to become also a nuclear power. The U.S. does not want Japan to become a nuclear power. It wants Japan to continue to be subordinate to the United States. And Japan is occupied. The occupation of Japan has never ended since the end of World War II. Tens of thousands of troops are all over Japan and Okinawa, as well as other bases in the area, but particularly Japan and Okinawa are key bases for the U.S. Military strategy in regard to Asia and its strategy of domination of Asia and global domination.
That's a very good point that you're making there. Since you mentioned China and Russia, Tony Gosling, I'm looking at a couple of important points there on China. One of them, which involves Russia also, is that the U.S. says that both Russia and China have the ability to have leverage on North Korea to stop them from conducting these tests, and it wants to see Russia and China do that. It's not as if you've been hosting Russia and China in such a cordial, warm manner, you know, right. when you then come out and make a I don't want to say demand, but asking both of them to do that. Why should Russia and China do that for the U.S.?
Well, they're not going to, I don't think, because actually what Kim Jong-un is doing is serving a very useful purpose, particularly for the Chinese. I mean, he is saber-rattling for the Chinese, I think, it's fair to say. The Chinese would much rather not be, you know, going for any confrontation. And obviously, at the moment, there are all sorts of domestic problems the Chinese have got to cope with demonstrations against the continued lockdowns and this sort of thing going on within China. It's serving, I think, a useful purpose, and it's very unlikely. When I say a useful purpose, I mean countering the bullying of the United States, effectively, and saying, well, look, you know, if you can play at this game of making nuclear threats, so can we. And although the United States isn't necessarily making those on CNN, what it's doing is it's moving its forces closer to China, and it's surrounding China. It's threatening to blockade China, basically, by its military manoeuvres. But I think that where the solutions might come to all of this, we need to look closely at there are high-level connections between the United States and China, which very rarely get talked about. There was a very good discussion about all this recently by James Corbett and Whitney Webb, two very good freelance journalists who I'm sure some of your viewers will know, at looking at the connections between the two. Now, this is a kind of deep state connection between the US and China. And so I think if there is going to be any dropping of these tensions, and of course, if that happens, that what we'll see is less saber-rattling from Kim Jong-un and less saber-rattling from the United States, maybe even some US troops going home from places like Japan we were just hearing about, other places in the Pacific, that's where this should start. But of course, there is also a very important party in all of this, and that is the arms lobby. The arms lobby are pushing so much of US policy. They are very, very close to, obviously, the military, the State Department, and the US government. And they are the people, I think, that are pushing all these saber-rattling and the tension, because they will simply make money out of any kind of conflict. Although, you know, many people think, well, we don't want a war. Why does anyone want a war? The arms lobby love wars. I hate to tell you, but they do, because they make a fantastic amount of money at it. And right. In the United States, they have the ear of Congress. They have the ear of President Biden. And the sorts of fear-mongering that the arms lobby come out with, I'm afraid, is the talk of the president and other people that talking about China and North Korea as a big threat, actually pushing their armed forces closer to these countries. And that is actually the arms lobby speaking. It's not the democratic people of the United States by any means.
Well, but to what degree is this, U.S. military going to go, even though they're interested, as our guest there said, the arms lobby is interested in these conflicts when we're talking about nuclear conflicts? I mean, Richard Becker, taking a look at what's happening in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. So you have a nuclear armed country there that the U.S. and Russia have exchanged statements amongst each other, with Russia at least proposing the idea of perhaps the use of nuclear weapons, even though it has said on many occasions that it's not going to do that. Or when it comes to the case of North Korea, of which the U.S. has also, in reaction, for example, gone ahead and has its B-52 bombers, for example, flying over. Even China itself has nuclear bombs. And also looking at the region in West Asia, or the Middle East, as some call it, its ally, Israel, that has nuclear bombs. I mean, these are tensions around the world involving nuclear weapons. And the common denominator here is the U.S.
That's right. And, you know, it's not that China wants to rule the world or North Korea wants to rule. That's not true. But it is true that the United States wants to rule the world. I mean, it's the policy, the national security strategy changed in 2018 to one of away from the war on terrorism, so-called, to major party competition or major party conflict. It's clear what that means. You know, and we have to remember when in the longer term context, that it was in February, I believe, of 2002 that Bush gave his infamous speech and the State of the Union, and it talked about the axis of evil. And it was a ridiculous speech, but very threatening to those who were the target, mainly the axis of evil being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iran and Iraq had had a war, an eight-year war with each other. They weren't exactly allies, and neither were allies. They might have friendly relations, but not allies with North Korea. And then what happened? Iraq was destroyed. Its state destroyed, and it remains destroyed today by the U.S. And then we have Libya was persuaded to give up its weapons programs, turn them over to the U.S., and then Libya was destroyed. So it was after the destruction of Iraq in the second Iraq war, U.S.-Iraq war, that North Korea resolutely set out that we're going to have a nuclear program, we're going to have nuclear weapons. They had been doing research before, but that really triggered the decision to go forward, we believe. And that is understandable. If you can't be able to respond to your adversary and your adversary is threatening your existence, well, you have a big problem. And so, you know, I think that's the context we have to see this in, is that it has been, as you said, the common denominator being the U.S. and its vast nuclear weapons program. I should also add, North Korea probably has 40 nuclear weapons at this point, maybe a little bit more than that. They can develop 6 or 7 a year. The United States has over 6,000 nuclear weapons and can destroy the entire planet with its nuclear arsenal in case of war. And that's where the great threat comes from in terms of nuclear weapons and what they can do to humanity and to the world that we live in.
We're just fresh out of time. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist. Thank you. Richard Becker, Anti-War Activist Answer Coalition from San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next Spotlight, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَلَقَدْ يَسَّرْنَا الْقُرْآنَ good.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we took up explanation of Surah Mumtahine, which means the woman tested, revealed in Medina regarding the examining of the faith of migrant women who renounce paganism and accept Islam. It has 13 ayahs and is number 60 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. Today, we complete it, and here are ayahs 7, 8, and 9.
عَسَى اللَّهُ أَن يَجْعَلَ بَيْنَكُمْ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ عَادَيْتُمْ مِنْهُمْ مَوَدَّةً وَاللَّهُ قَدِيرٌ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم إن الله يحب المقسطين إنما ينهاكم الله عن الذين قاتلوكم في الدين وأخرجوكم من دياركم وظاهروا على إخراجكم أن تولوهم ومن يتولهم فأولئك هم الظالمون.
It may be that Allah will bring about affection between you and those with whom you are at enmity. And Allah is all-powerful, and Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful. Allah does not forbid you from dealing with kindness and justice with those polytheists who did not make war against you on account of religion and did not expel you from your homes. Indeed, Allah loves the just. Allah forbids you only in regard to those who made war against you on account of religion and expelled you from your homes and supported the polytheists of Mecca in your expulsion, that you make friends with them, and whoever makes friends with them, it is they who are the wrongdoers. If you might recall, last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said that it was not possible for a person to claim to be obedient to God and the Prophet, as well as those who are the enemies of faith and believers, even if they happen to be relatives. Bonds based upon religion take precedence over family bonds and are thus the deciding factor for one's salvation towards the bliss of paradise or falling to the bowels of hell. We also said that the words and deeds of the prophets are divine inspiration, and they are thus the practical exemplars or role model for all of us, especially for the believers. The ayahs that we recited to you tell the Muslims who had migrated from Mecca to Medina that your polytheist relatives of Mecca may embrace Islam in the near future and that enmity will turn into friendship. God does not forbid the believers from having ties and doing good in a just manner with those non-Muslims who neither confronted Muslims nor drove them out of their homeland. He solely forbids you to refrain from befriending those who fought against you because of your faith and drove you out of your homeland or contributed to your being driven out. And whoever befriends them is a wrongdoer disobeying Allah's command. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the criterion for kindness or enmity between Muslims and others are religious teachings on whose basis non-Muslims who have not mistreated Muslims should be dealt with affection, while those who confronted the believers should be disavowed. Number two, if the enemies end their hostility, we should overlook their misbehavior of the past. Number three, Islam is the religion of justice even towards disbelievers. And number four, charity and good deeds should cover the needy disbelievers as well. Now let us listen to ayahs 10 and 11 of the same surah.
يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِذَا جَاءَكُمُ الْمُؤْمِنَاتُ مُهَاجِرَاتٍ فَامْتَحِنُوهُنَّ اللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ بِإِيمَانِهِنَّ فإن علمتموهن مؤمنات فلا ترجعوهن إلى الكفار لا هن حل لهم ولا هم يحلون لهن وآتوهم ما أنفقوا ولا جناح عليكم أن تنكحوهن إذا آتيتموهن أجورهن ولا تمسكوا بعصم الكوافر واسألوا ما أنفقتم وليسألوا ما أنفقوا ذلكم حكم الله يحكم بينكم والله عليم حكيم وإن فاتكم شيء من أزواجكم إلى الكفار فعاقبتم فآتوا الذين ذهبت أزواجهم مثل ما أنفقوا واتقوا الله الذي أنتم به مؤمنون.
Oh, you who have faith, when faithful women come to you as immigrants, test them. Allah knows best the state of their faith. Then, if you ascertain them to be genuinely faithful women, do not send them back to the faithless. They are not lawful for them, nor are they lawful for them, but give them what dowry they have spent for them. There is no sin upon you in marrying them when you have given them their dowries. Do not hold on to conjugal ties with faithless women. Demand from the infidels what you have spent as dowries, and let the faithless demand from you what they have spent as dowries. That is Allah's judgment. He judges between you, and Allah is all-knowing, all-wise. If anything of the dowries pertaining to your wives is not reclaimed from the faithless, and then you have your turn, then give to those whose wives have left them the like of what they have spent, and be wary of Allah in whom you have faith. These ayahs discuss conjugal relations of a couple when one of them becomes faithless while the other is faithful. If an immigrant woman seeks refuge with the Muslims, she should be examined. And in case her belief is ascertained, she should not be handed over to the disbelievers. Islam, however, is the faith of justice and neither leaves the immigrant woman on her own, nor ignores the right of the disbeliever husband, who should be reimbursed for what he had spent upon her. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, a husband cannot force the wife to follow his faith. Number two, conjugal life ends between a couple if either has become faithless. Number three, if an infidel woman claims to have become Muslim, her case ought to be thoroughly examined to ascertain the reason, whether it is sincerity or not more than mere passionate attachment to a Muslim man, or still a case of espionage. And number four, the rights of non-Muslims ought to be observed irrespective of their belief. We conclude this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment by presenting you the last two ayahs of Surah Mumtahineh, 12 and 13.
Ya ayyuhan nabiy idha ja'aka almu'minatu yubay'unaka 'ala an la yushrikna billahi shay'an wa la yasriquna wa la yaznina wa la yaqtulna awladahun ولا يقتلن أولادهن ولا يأتين ببهتان يفترينه بين أيديهن وأرجلهن ولا يعصينك في معروف فبايعهن واستغفر لهن الله إن الله غفور رحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تتولوا قوما غضب الله عليهم قد يئسوا من الآخرة كما يئس الكفار من أصحاب القبور.
O Prophet, if faithful women come to you to take the oath of allegiance to you, pledging that they shall not ascribe any partners to Allah, that they shall not steal, nor commit adultery, nor kill their children, nor utter any slander that they may have intentionally fabricated, nor disobey you in what is right, then accept their allegiance and plead for them to Allah for forgiveness. Indeed, Allah is all forgiving, all merciful. O you who have faith, do not befriend the people at whom Allah is wrathful. They have despaired of the hereafter, just as the faithless have despaired of the occupants of the graves. These ayahs pertain to the faithless women who claimed to have accepted Islam at the peaceful surrender of Mecca to the Muslims. Certain conditions have to be met before accepting Islam, as is evident in the ayah itself, which forbids the wife to steal from her husband, commit adultery in his absence, abort the pregnancy, indulge in slander and several other evils, which should be cleansed from the society in order to make the Islamic environment sound and healthy. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, in Islam, a woman is an independent person who has her own rights. And number two, cleansing the society from financial and sexual corruption sets the ground for a sound and healthy atmosphere, since many social ills stem from unbridled marital relations. Well, that marks the end of Surah Mumtahineh. Next week, we will start explanation of Surah Saf. God bless upon you and goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.